Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I talk to people who are part of a spiritual culture that's emerging in this country and around the world. And tonight's guest is someone who's who's in touch with where we came from, our past, our kind of spiritual traditions of the land and of the people. His name is Evan Pritchard, and he is also the director of the Center for Algonquin Culture. He's a historian, and I think, like I said in the pre-interview, Evan, let's talk about sort of like the history of the land in spiritual terms. You know what I mean? The history of New York, particularly. I recently read this book called The Occult History of America, but it talked about the power in the land in upstate New York, and that's sort of where you're centered. What is it about the land up there? And we'll talk about maybe other places you visit, but what is it in New York that produced people like the Fox Sisters that started the spiritualist movement and Joseph Smith and a bunch of, and that other guy, Andrew Jackson Davis, that maybe we'll talk about too. But what is in the land in this area?
Well, one, you know, it's my belief, very practically minded. I mean, I am, you know, I look into the other dimensions and I'm a mystic, but a lot of things like that in history, I like to try to be as practical as possible. And I believe one of the things is that the Hudson Valley is a great estuary, comparable to the Nile, the Yellow River, the Tigris and Euphrates, and the Indus Valley. And it has a similar history to those places in that the earliest peoples gathered around the estuary of the Hudson, what we call the Hudson River, which was the Mohicanituk, or the greatest of rivers that flows both ways. And the environment was very, very rich and fertile, and there was plenty to eat for everybody, so they never had to want for anything as compared to other regions. So a great civilization grew up here and went through many, many phases, just like, you know, Sumeria or India, and a great philosophy developed. And what happened was is that there were so many of these people, and they became known to us as the Lenape, but that's apparently not what they called themselves, but they was this great civilization in the Hudson Valley, and then it spread, you know, in every direction. And, you know, these were very, in their own way, intellectual, intelligent, you know, open-minded people, mind-expanded people who were fully living on all six cylinders, so to speak, even before the engine. And so what happened is after contact with Europe, they were up to it. You know, there was not militarily in every case, but there was a lot of conversation, intermarriage. And those enlightened minds of these people, Lenape people or Mohican people, greatly influenced these people, and also intermarried with the Dutch and the English. And so their children became these great giants like Andrew Jackson Davis. Both parents were half Lenape, and he couldn't talk about it during the time of Andrew Jackson's reign, which is when he was born, but he definitely was, you know, both his parents were mixed blood. And so most of what he wrote about, and he was the father of American spiritualism, but it was all straight out of the, you know, Lenape culture. And the same could be said for many of the people. Like, on the other hand, they influenced people by inspiration. Like, for example, Andrew Jackson Davis inspired Sojourner Truth, who was not native as far as we know. But he really took her under his wing and trained her, and so she went on to become a great feminist and then ultimately became a friend to Abraham Lincoln. So that's what's going on, and the Hudson Valley has continued to be that, you know, a great cradle of ideas, and a surprising number of the great, you know, mystics and geniuses have lived in the Hudson Valley during American history. I give the credit to the Lenape, but they would give the credit to the land itself, because it was so beautiful and so exquisitely rich for food and wildlife. And if you understand how estuaries work, you know, you have something called iodine that's in marine life that is not very common in the interior. So that actually helps the health and vitality of the people, but it's also a kind of more variety of nutrition leads to greater population. So that's just a little bit.
Wait, so an estuary is a river that flows, also the sea flows into the river. Like you said, it's a river that flows. Most rivers just flow into the ocean and that's it. But the Hudson, I guess, is wide enough and has a sort of tide and pulls ocean water into the fresh water. And that's an estuary, right? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And it's, unusual. I mean, there are small estuaries, but there are very few big estuaries in the world, and almost all of them were cradles of civilization. But what happened was the Hudson was the cradle of what archaeologists call the Orient Point culture, and they were a high mystical culture with some similarities to Egypt, but no apparent connection, we don't know. But this was a gigantic kind of civilization. They had very advanced spirituality, which we can see through the ceremonies they did for the burials of the dead. And there was about 1,000 B.C. that they hit their height. And the Lenape people and Mohicans are their descendants. But when the white people came, they pretty much brushed aside this whole culture to a certain extent, didn't recognize how great it was, or some did, but those people didn't write the history books. And so what happened was this tremendous opportunity for global consciousness expansion did not really happen in a clear way. It happened through the back door, through these visionaries. And Joseph Smith was also connected to the native people in a number of ways up where he was, and as I guess history tells us. But I mean, you look at the accomplishments. The women's movement, by the way, in upstate New York was almost entirely organized by Converse. Maxwell Converse is a woman who had a father of mixed blood who entirely followed the clues of the Mohawk women. She was adopted Mohawk, and so were most of the original founders of the women's movement, Mott, and on and on, the whole list. They all got involved with the Mohawks, Oneida, Seneca, and of course Seneca Falls was the site of all the first early meetings. So these were visionary women. Elizabeth Converse, Maxwell Converse, I believe his name is, was like really the driving force, a mixed blood woman. Any particular case you look at, there's a native connection, and the reason why that's so important is because the natives here were very strong in their beliefs, and they're still here. They've never been completely eradicated, in spite of 400 years of really incredible persecution that has never made the history books or the papers.
Well, going back to the estuary, the reason they became the centers of great civilization was because the vegetation was more lush and fertile, or was there a sort of a spiritual energy as well that people felt, or maybe they're both connected, in that way?
Oh, yes, I believe that. I think that's just as important. It's harder to pin down. But yes, the water has a spiritual component to it. And the fact that there are one of the wonderful things about the Hudson Valley that the Nile just doesn't have. We're better here than have it better off than the Nile because we have waterfalls on our tributaries, and these waterfalls were places where the native people would pray and meditate as part of their spiritual practice. And there's a waterfall called Petalconk, which means the waterfalls where we make our prayers near the Samsonville Road over by Medicons, but that's near Accord. But all the waterfalls were places to pray, and Hudson Valley has more waterfalls than most places in the world. Some of them, even the people here don't know about, because nobody really accentuates them. But my vision is that someday people will be taking echo tours even now in the Hudson Valley and go visiting those waterfalls and making tobacco offerings for the land. But beyond that, there is something ineffably spiritual about a river. I mean, there's nothing like a river. You look at it and, you're cleansed in a sense. And the people of India knew the Ganges as just, Mother Ganga, that was like a spirit actual goddess that had taken the form of a river. And, you know, there was probably an entity that the Lenape saw in the river, and I don't know specifically what, but they might have seen that as a great goddess at some point, certainly feminine. And the Delaware, too. The Delaware River is part of this region, and the Delaware was considered extremely sacred. And the what we call Trenton was really the headwaters of the Delaware. They called Sunkeeg, which means it's the head of the arm of the sea, but it's feminine. It's a feminine word. Sunk is feminine for the female, you know, powerful head deity. So there you go. You know, it's right there if you speak the language. Mm-hmm. Beautiful stuff, you know.
So the Native Americans formed, pretty much throughout North America, they probably formed their cultures around rivers. Is that also what you're saying?
Or right. For a very long list of reasons. And somewhere, you know, I did write about this, and that it didn't get into any of the major books, but there's at least 12 reasons, and I can't remember them all now, but why Native people preferred estuaries. One is that you have free transportation both ways without rowing up and down, depending on the tides. You know, you have that mix of marine life and freshwater life, you have, which the other animals are attracted to. You know, you have the beauty of the waterfalls for meditation. They used the rivers as highways. And also there were places where people would stop before crossing the river. They had ferry systems, ferry boat systems, and all the major trail crossings across the Hudson. So that attracted, you know, people to kind of set down roots there.
The Native people created ferry boat systems for their people. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, they did. They used, I know this for sure, I researched it, they used tulip trees, very large trees, and they hollowed them out. And they could carry, you know, 10 passengers at a time. These big log canoes, you know, of our area with the dugouts, rode pretty low in the water, so 10 was probably, you know, probably reasonable. But at all our major trade crossings, the colonists saw these and described them, in some cases, took over the business from the natives. Like at Dobbs Ferry, there was a Native ferry service that the Dobbs family and their predecessors took over. At the Poughkeepsie, there's colonial records of people, natives running a ferry boat crossing at an angle over to Highland Landing from the bottom of Main Street, all up and down the Hudson, from Beacon over to the Newburgh Marina was a log canoe. So, and you know, they would put tobacco down in the river before crossing it, either in a boat or by foot. Obviously, in the Hudson, you need the boat. But they were very propitious towards the river and always gave it, you know, offerings as if it were this, even to them, was a living being.
Was that time, I mean, before the Europeans came, was that kind of a time of, like, paradise almost? Because you also hear about the Native Americans also creating a lot of wars amongst themselves. So what's the true history before the white man, you know, before Europeans?
Well, the true history was it was absolutely paradise. And, of course, they felt that, you know, was normal and expected. One thing that I recently realized is that Palaupiel, which is their name for Bannerman's Island, it contains B or P, which means drinking water. And it tells us that the Hudson River at Bannerman's Island was considered drinkable by them, which just gives you just one more clue as to how incredible everything was. But there were whole schools of dolphins and whales in the Hudson, very thick. The oysters were a foot across, and the clams were very large. Lobsters were 7 feet long. Birds filled the air of all kinds, almost too loud at times, right in New York City and all the way up the Hudson. And it really was literally paradise. And it just they also knew how to live on the land. And that's a whole other thing in terms of, like, how you actually can, you know, live off the land. It takes some skill and knowledge, and they had that knowledge. So it was like paradise to them. And they would be shocked to see what we've done with it. It's just, you know, they really, I know they would. And I've been talking lately to people about the land keepers. They had a tradition where somebody was like a spiritual mystic, and when they passed on, where they're ready to, you know, go to the other side, they would make a vow that they would stay in an interdimensional place and continue to watch over and guard the land and the environment. And thousands of people see these entities called land keepers, and most of the tribes around, like, North and South America, a lot of them have these traditions and still talk about that, and many people see them. And so I've been setting up a series of workshops to help people communicate with them in these times of ecological disaster, with the oil spills and with, I mean, even earthquakes are disasters, not necessarily ecological. So I'm going around this year and giving workshops all over, and it's actually, I have about 35 different events coming up. But I'd like to mention them at some point.
Yeah, no, just tell people how they could find, you could tell them right now, like, how they could find out, like, what new events are coming up.
Yeah, so I have a website at www.algonquinculture.org. That's ALGONQUINCULTURE.org. And you can also email me at evan.pritchard7, which is evan.pritchard7@gmail.com. That's my email. Also I have a newsletter that goes out, and there's also a blog, booksoflight.blogspot.com. I have a seminar coming up in Maryland. If anybody's out there listening from Maryland, I've got that coming up on in April.
What's that seminar about? What are you going to cover in that seminar?
April 23rd is connecting with the land keepers. Oh. It's part of the land keeper awareness training seminars that I'm doing in Maryland. It's one day on the 23rd, but also on April 30th in Rhinebeck. So people want to call me, my home number there is 845-266-9231. I'm doing a lot of the Connecting with the Land Keepers workshops. I'm going to be doing one at the Open Center in Manhattan coming up. That's pretty exciting. And that's on four different weeks, that May 25th, June 8th, and then June 15th and June 22nd, all at the Open Center in Manhattan. A very well-known spot, of course, dividing up the training into four parts. And the thing is that what I cover is things that you need in order to contact these spirits of these very people that built this great civilization, you know, in the Hudson Valley and other places, that you can actually communicate with them and ask to help them or ask them to help you.
Can you give us just a little taste of the kind of things that we might need if we wanted to connect with the land keepers?
Well, yeah, there's some very simple things and there's some very difficult things, like simply being able to kind of calm yourself and go within and travel to another dimension. You could ask for these entities, to make an offering to them, to the earth, for example, with tobacco or cornmeal. Some of them prefer to speak their own language, but you can use, if you can learn Indian Sign Language, which I teach, or Lenape or Mohican or Mi'kmaq or any of these languages, even a few words, it really helps. And what I do in the workshops is, I hand out sheets with prayers and things you can practice saying that are in their languages. It really, even talking to plant spirits, talking the language of the land makes this huge difference. You know, there's 12 different points. Like, one thing is to how to recognize a land keeper as opposed to, say, a Manitou or a Basingwe or all these different entities. A land keeper is a human being that has passed on, and they're still somewhat in the human consciousness. So you have to kind of respect that they have their limitations. You know, it's not like they're gods or angels. And, they're very humble people. They usually are seen wearing like deer skin. They usually have white hair because they're usually pretty old by the time they reach this stage. They're very peaceful people, and they often don't say anything. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, but they're very, you know, beautiful, beatific beings. And they're just there to help. They help the plants and trees grow, and they help people who are dedicated to the environment. And a lot of people see them.
Have you seen them, Evan?
Yes. Oh, yes.
You have?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I guess that's why you're...
Well, I was giving workshops at the Open Center on Landkeepers back in 2001, and then, of course, you know, this incident happened with the World Trade Center, and these therapists who were there had taken my training and then were doing hypnotherapy with people who were victims of 9/11, and they all started seeing these landkeepers, but the therapists knew from taking the workshops what they were, and they were encouraged to work with them, and it was very healing for some people, you know, in that situation. And I saw one came to me at the moment of the 9/11 incident. I was sleeping in my bed, not in New York City, and a landkeeper came to me, and he said, "Namat Tawny, Namat Tawny," because occasionally they do talk, and of course, I was supposed to know this, and I said, I know what you're saying, I can't quite get it, so I went into my notes, and I found that it meant, Alaris means it means, like, what are they doing to my town, you know? Like, what's happening to my town? But it had other levels of meaning. But, you know, it's like a shame, you know. So this was the landkeeper for Manhattan.
Wow. Wow.
And so I didn't know what was going on, but that certainly got my attention. And then my phone rang, and my friend said, Air Force One is in the air. You better get out of bed.
So that's pretty amazing. So these beings are there. And they're here for us to communicate with and help them keep the focus on the land or help them in some ways, right?
Yes, we can help them by, they can't do a whole lot without us in terms of pollution. They're good at, you know, transferring their energy directly into plants and trees who are sensitive, and even animals. But in terms of pollution, I mean, you know, they're limited because they're dead, basically. And so if they can communicate to us if we're really sensitive and really open to what they're saying. We can even, you know, pass on messages to people, maybe even without saying so, without claiming that it's some kind of channeling, of course. Mm-hmm. But we can. Well, they need us right now, and we also need to invite them. And, you know, the Kogi in Colombia are making a lot of, you know, rounds and traveling, and they have been talking about this. That's kind of where I got inspired by this indirectly, through the Kogis coming up here and saying, you know, where are all your landkeepers? We don't see, when we look through the dimensions, we don't see a lot of landkeepers here, and we're worried. You know, are you not inviting them? And everybody looks at each other, what? We didn't know we were supposed to. So, well, invite them, you know. And so I kind of picked up from there. That was way back in, I think, 1999. And now this year, I got the message that the landkeepers want, like, much more attention, much more help on that. Because, you know, there's things happening. The prophecies of the seven fires and everything, or, you know, which is a whole other thing that we talk about in the workshops. But you know, we're in kind of a situation here. The earth is starting to shake a little bit, as we say, and the landkeepers need more of our energy, you know, and we need theirs.
The landkeepers can do their job better as far as like giving energy to the land when we recognize that they are there. And
I think what it is, and this again, you know, I try to be careful about speaking for them, mm-hmm. but. I think they can help the plants pretty well as long as the environment is clear, because that's part of their normal job, but they're not. Oh. When they passed away, there was no pollution.
Right.
And so in terms of, reaching the more energy in order to overcome some of the pollution that the plants are soaking in or the animals are ingesting, or the frogs especially, or the birds being influenced by electromagnetism, they... you know, from, like, cell phone towers. But the landkeepers need our help for those kind of situations, and now that's becoming almost a universal. You see what I'm saying?
Go ahead. No, I'm with you. Yes.
So they need our help more now because of the changes in the environment that they could not have foreseen. You know, and so, they come out of this great culture, which again started out, people call it Orient Point culture, but it was a very high mystical culture with a lot of powerful teachings that still exist in what is now the Algonquin culture. And of course, you know, I'm the director of the Center for Algonquin Culture. This is what I do. But they were, you know, from various eras, you know, they learned these techniques and prepared themselves to pass into the spirit world at death and to continue to help with the land. And I've seen a lot of them, and you know, a lot of people have reported this, like psychics, for example, of all races who come to New York in particular, you know, see them, but they're everywhere. I mean, the Hopi and the Cherokee, the, Mi'kmaq, Mohican, I would say there's several other significant, like Incas and Mayans. In particular, the Mayans talk about land keepers all the time in some detail. And, of course, the Kogi. They all recognize this as being very, very important, and more important now than ever. So all I'm doing is, what I do is I go around and I pass on teachings that I've learned from the elders and reconstructing that beautiful world that you're referring to, that paradise, and the teachings that are so relevant today. And so I'm doing these 35 events, and this is like an 8-hour seminar on landkeeper, connecting with the landkeepers, that, you know, you need 8 hours to learn all that you can learn about them to help them. There's a lot of aspects to it. Like I say, some of it is developing the telepathic ability, but also other ways to communicate the offerings, looking for signs in the birds from them, because they can interact with birds and give you signs through them. There's, you know, like I say, sign language. They're speaking their language, figuring out what nation they are by, for example, the shoes that they wear. Even if they can't talk to you, they might show you their shoes, and their shoes might be unique to their particular, or moccasins, excuse me, particular to their tribe.
But you said the Kogis didn't see that many of them, but you're also saying
less
there are some.
Yeah, seeing less of them.
But why are there less? Are there, they're just because we're not helping? I mean, we're not recognizing, so they're sort of disappearing? I mean, why would there be less?
Well, there are less bees, too, aren't there? I don't know. But, it's disturbing. They were asking us, you know, what we were doing, why we don't have so many landkeepers, and they believed it might be because, you know, that we weren't inviting them. And also, there's aspects of the landkeepers that probably few humans, even the Kogi, don't understand. You know, these are from another era. They're mysterious, and they're very pure vibrationally, you know, and as humans, they were more innocent and pure than almost anybody today, and to be in their presence really is uplifting. But also, you know, they have aspects of their lives we don't understand. Mm-hmm. And I see there's other entities too. The Misingwe are the 3-foot-tall woodland beings that people think of as fairies or brownies or whatever, but they're Native American. And there's elemental spirits, and there's manitous, which are very interesting. And there's the great spirit itself. The Manitou itself is, you know, the great mystery, who's the great medicine, whose voice is heard in the wind, you know. And that's well, part. They all work together.
Who was the beings that supposedly, who did Henry Hudson see when he went to some strange ceremony when his boats first came up the river and he was invited to something and he was kind of freaked out, I think, or his people were freaked out about some, you know, it's a kind of historic thing. Do you know what I'm talking about with Henry Hudson?
Well, you know, I mean, I wrote a book on Henry Hudson and went to every word that he and his first mate, Robert Jewett, wrote. But he didn't really write about a freaky ceremony. Yeah. That was the next fellow from Holland was Christiansen and Adrian Bloch, and they described dances on Danskammer Point, and they called it the Devil's dance chamber, the Deuvel Danskammer, and they saw them jumping over the fire and doing some kind of dance at night that they thought was scary and satanic. That was not really Henry Hudson. He was very respectful of the natives. Mm. And Robert Jewett was afraid of everybody, and Robert Jewett was the one who just carried all these weapons on him. And I want to mention, if I have a moment here, about the Seven Fires prophecies.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, everyone's talking about 2012 prophecies and all that.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right, that's Mayan. Yeah. So the Seven Fires prophecies has a calendar that's very exact, and it's these cycles of 112 years, and there's seven of those cycles, and it cites, I think, 1216 A.D., where the prophets came. And the moment that Henry Hudson entered the Delaware Bay was the very end of the year that started the second half of that 784-year cycle. And these people knew that because they were following their calendars on their moon turtles. It's a whole thing that they, you know, they were measuring time by what's called moon turtles and measuring the cycles of the moon and sun separately. So Hudson arrived in the last moment of this important cycle of the moon from an eclipse and this middle of the 784-year cycle, and they were looking for a sign, and the teachings told them that at this time was a time of duality when visitors would come from the other side, from the east, either bearing gifts and friendship and teaching or bearing hatred and faces of anger and weaponry. And it was interesting that Henry Hudson was this wonderful kind of happy-go-lucky, gift-giving, generous man with lots of wisdom. And his first mate that he basically grew up with, a little bit younger, was Robert Jewett, who was packing pistols and hiding them everywhere. Ended up, Robert Jewett killed 13 of these Native Americans without really good cause. You know, they were trying to complain about him, and he started shooting them with cannons and pistols or blunderbusses. And so you had the duality there, and the timing was insanely accurate. So, of course, the natives felt at first that he was a god, you know, because of the timing. And then they realized that it was both prophecies came true at the same time. And from then, we've had this increasing polarity, an increasing, you know, conflicts between the dark and the light. And things have gotten out of balance. And you see that in Manhattan today. You have Goldman Sachs right there where Henry Hudson landed, near where he landed. And you also have, like, the Dalai Lama giving speeches to 500,000 people in Central Park. You know, Manhattan has become this vortex for the prophecies. And the time cycle ends on September 11, 2001, according to my book. And you can look all the research I did to prove that. I think nobody has really taken the issue with it because it's pretty astoundingly, you know, I'm willing to be proven wrong by the next person.
Wait, you said that the cycle would end? I mean, you said this before 2001, that the cycle would end on September 11th?
I figured it out. It was in code, and while I was writing the book, I figured it out to my satisfaction and hopefully to some of my readers.
Well, that's exciting. Hello?
Well, you know, Graham Hancock put a lot of this on his website in terms of, I wrote it, you know, and added to his website, and people wrote in, this was last summer, about the actual astronomy involved, which is really pretty complex. But if anybody wants to go on the Graham Hancock site, they can look at my August entries of last year. And, you know, I answered people's questions concerning the seven fires and all the astronomy involved, which is a lot of math. But, yeah, it comes to September 11, 2001, was the end of the seven fire cycle according to this calendar system. And then after that, according to the prophecies, we go into this limbo time where we have to decide, as the people of the Turtle Island, of all races, the four races, whether we're going to create this new rainbow race and continue 1,000 years of peace, or whether we're going to totally destroy ourselves and the planet. And the earthquakes, I'm sorry.
That's okay. The earthquakes are part of that. Well, why don't you go through why they call it the seven fires? Because I think that's really fascinating.
Right, because each of the 112-year cycles is called a fire for various reasons. And so there's seven of them lined up one after another. Again, you know, there was a great book by Eddie Benton Benes, which is unfortunately out of print, called the Meshomas book. And it goes into much, you know, a lot of detail about the whole thing. But that is a little hard to get right now. But
no, it's okay. But, you know, so they, so are we through the seven fires? Is that like the final thing? So we have a choice, you're saying, between going, you know, towards harmony or continuing on a downward spiral. And this is that limbo period between now and what time? Like, what's their time frame that they give us?
Well, they weren't specific. They said that, you know, after the end of this 7-hour period, we could go into the eighth fire, and they didn't say when that would begin, but they watched eclipses. And one thing that I found is that there were solar eclipses visible from the point that the prophets arrived, every node of the wheel, for nine consecutive times. And the odds are zillions and trillions and billions to one that that would ever happen, because
I don't follow you. There were prophets where for these eclipses? What do you mean?
The prophets arrived at New Brunswick, and there's a particular island where they came and met with the people, according to the scrolls and the birch bark records. And from that place, you could see nine consecutive solar eclipses, you know, full solar eclipses from that site, or at least see most of them, for each of the nodes for nine consecutive times. And that was in the middle of this whole cycle that they predicted. So they watched eclipses carefully. There were no eclipses visible from that spot of 2001 with the very end of it, and there won't be any eclipses visible from that spot until 2017 and then 2024. And my own personal feeling is that those eclipses are going to be strong warnings, and I would say we'd better try to get to the eighth fire by 2024 at the latest.
But who were these prophets? What do you mean the prophets? Who are these people?
The prophets of the seven fires. They came with, they, like, almost superhuman knowledge of the future.
Were they native people, or did they come from another dimension or something?
They were not native people. Knows who they are. Nobody knows that.
This is Lenape legend that you're saying?
All the Algonquins follow the seven fires teachings in the Bedouin lodges, and the Lenape were a big part of that. The Ojibwe, the ones that have held on to the knowledge. And again, people have different interpretations of all this, and I'm just presenting my view, which, you know, I present in the book Henry Hudson and the Algonquins, to, you know, with all the math and all the different proofs of whatnot to satisfy the Western mind. But, you know, so far I'm just saying that that seems to hold up. People seem to feel it's a pretty good theory. And these people, according to the elders, were not Native American.
Right. They weren't Native American. They were from somewhere else that we don't know where they were from.
That's right. They just showed up one after another at this particular place. And I believe it was in the early 1200s. And that each of these cycles being 112 years is part of the teaching that a lot of people are familiar with in terms of the medicine wheels and the cycles. But they predicted all these things that would happen very accurately.
When you say New Brunswick, do you mean in Canada, New Brunswick?
Yeah.
Or?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, in Canada, where the Mi'kmaqs are. And that's where my people are from.
Oh, your people are Mi'kmaqs?
Yes.
Was there a lot of communication and exchange of these kind of information before the European? I mean, what was the kind of interconnected cultures between the tribes and their spiritual knowledge, and because they had different languages, of course, and different cultures and different histories, but what was the kind of overall communication like?
Oh, well, most of the Algonquins' languages were much more similar. They were mostly of what I call the Nemeu type, which is similar to Mohican, which is rarely spoken today. But their languages were similar. And then after contact, these languages divided into 36 languages of the Algonquins. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to kind of bring that back into unity. And unfortunately, it's extremely complicated to understand any one of these languages today, but they are spoken. But so in those days, there was much less of a barrier of language, and all the people that are now Algonquin, their ancestors all had some familiarity with the what now called the Midewin or the different lodges, and they were familiar with these prophecies. And people in Canada still are very familiar with the prophecies just from word of mouth. I'll just say that I was giving a lecture in Canada with a room of about 30 people who were all mixed bloods, and I said, how many of you grew up hearing about the Seven Fires prophecies? And every single person in the room raised their hand. Now, what's interesting about that is that nothing had ever been published on the Seven Fires prophecies, except for, like, the Meshomas book.
Mm-hmm. Wait, one more question. When you say Algonquin, that's a group of tribes that include the Lenape and other related tribes, right?
That's right. There's 84 very famous nations and hundreds of others in that grouping, and they are somewhat united by belief in Manitou, and this is what I focus on. But also, you know, you have the Lakota, the Cherokee, and you have the, you know, obviously the Iroquois or Haudenosaunee, and
I
wanted to mention that they could all communicate by sign language very easily until 1930. And then something happened about 1930 where everybody stopped using sign language. And I think it might have been because a lot of them had to move to cities in order to make money or survive or whatever, because there was kind of a downturn in the economy and also in the environment.
You're saying all the Native Americans could communicate across North America with sign language.
That's
a pretty amazing culture that just existed like that then, isn't it? I mean,
yes, it is. And this is definitely the case, that the sign language is so old that everybody understood the same version of it.
Wow. How come there hasn't been more anthropological studies about that? Or maybe there has been, but...
There hasn't been nearly enough on this. People, I don't know why. I mean, I think people do take it seriously. You see it in a lot of movies, but there hasn't been very much. Some anthropologists feel that it must be 9,000 years old to be spread all the way into Central America of the same exact system. And it actually influenced American Sign Language through the Wampanoags. But it's a beautiful practice, and I enjoy teaching sign and to communicate by sign. I mean, I don't know every single sign, but, I continue to develop. I learned from a Ramapo man first, and then started to, you know, go asking the elders, and then there's a book, can't remember the author, but there's some things that can be learned.
But I am more interested in the spiritual traditions, like why tobacco was such a sacred plant, and did they have tobacco up in upstate New York? And
they had two kinds. One was what's called the Iroquois style tobacco, was a golden tobacco. Because on the coast, they had green tobacco, and there's another kind that isn't actually tobacco. It's another, I can't remember.
But why is it so important?
It's so important because it's part of creation. I'll tell you this, it's really hard to explain it without telling you the story, is that the first man Glooskap went out to explore the world for the first time as a human being, and he could talk to the plants, which our elders can even today. You know that, and says to the plant, you know, what is your name? And what is your mission? You know, what is your purpose? And how can I interact with you? And, you know, he'd go to the lettuce, and the lettuce would say, oh, you know, eat me in your salad. And he'd go to the sunflower and say, use my seeds. And then he went to tobacco, and he said, and what are you for? What is your name? And in Mi'kmaq, it's Temak, or Temoe, actually. So he said, oh, Temoe, well, what do I use you for? Do I put you in a salad? Tobacco said, oh, no. He says, do I make a tea out of you? And tobacco says, I don't think so. He says, what do I do with you? And tobacco says, I am your communication between you and the Creator, and I will keep that communication line open. you can offer me to any of the spirits, and they will be very pleased with this offering. And you can burn, you know, me, and the smoke will take your prayers to heaven. And you can crumble me up, you know, and hold me in your hand, and I will be a medium of your thoughts and energy into the, you know, the hole in the earth, the water, the wind, the fire, all those things, and my energy will take your prayers right to heaven. And so the thing is that they, you know, the people try this, and it's amazing that, it, you know, it works for them, and it works dramatically well. And so if you keep doing something that keeps working, you're going to do it. Cigars, by the way, are a Mayan contribution to culture. The cigar means, in Mayan, you smoke it. And then, of course, cigarettes are a bastardization, excuse my French, of that with all the crap that's in them. But, you know, the only culture that had the elbow pipe was the Native American. No other culture in the world had that elbow pipe, you know, the L-shaped pipe. And everybody got it from, you know, Sir Walter Raleigh when he came over in the 1500s. That's part of our culture. And so we put the tobacco in the pipe, and we do ceremony, and we communicate with the Creator directly. It's like a radio, a two-way, you know, CB, or what do you want to say. The pipe is very, very powerful.
So tobacco, I mean, is a... Well, all the plants were beings. They weren't just unconscious pieces of vegetable. They had
a spiritual significance.
But it is then sort of ironic that tobacco would become sort of a plague to the Europeans, in a sense. You know, I mean,
yes, that's right. And wine became a plague to the Native Americans. They didn't have wine. And yet for the Europeans, it was a religious symbol, just as tobacco was religious, in a sense, to the natives. So that is ironic, because they didn't have a natural limit on it. Like, the natives would respect tobacco, and they had traditions and taboos to keep it in its place and to not overuse it. And the Europeans had similar customs about wine. They would do it religiously in a ceremony, but they wouldn't really go to such excess. So, the natural tobacco really isn't that bad for you. It has traces of nicotine and other things, but they would never, you know, overdo it.
It wasn't always smoked.
Tobacco was used more for ceremonial purposes, such as pouring it on the ground when you cut a tree or plant as an offering to pay for what you receive, and not to necessarily smoke.
Well, doesn't that mean sort of like the as we adopt other cultures, we need to know the kind of spiritual backgrounds of the use of those substances in order to be in harmony with the thing itself? We need to know the traditions and the customs.
Yeah. Well, right. That's right. And you know, the white people did pick up on tobacco as being important. The natives used it for currency, and a single leaf was like a dollar bill. And if you look at the earliest dollar bills, say, especially in Maryland, there was tobacco pictures. They looked like tobacco, but they were paper. And then even you look on the dollar bill now, and there's kind of stylized tobacco leaves that don't look like anything.
Mm-hmm.
But the whites recognized the importance of tobacco right away.
So tobacco is this sort of interdimensional communicator, and the more you offer it in a ceremony, in a way, the more goodwill comes to you. Is that the idea about tobacco? I mean,
No, it's not like that. It's a way of exchange, and also a medium of communication, because you can – two things. One is that you can actually kind of make a deal with the universe, so to say, is that if you want something in particular, like an answer or wisdom, you know, through tobacco, you can actually make an offer and say, I will, you know, I offer this to you in exchange for thus and such. And, of course, you might not get it. This is not meant to be, but hopefully not. But that's how they see it. You know, you make that offering and you get something in return. So it's just an exchange, like payment. But also, the tobacco carries energy, and it carries your energy to the thing that you're giving it to or offering it. So it's a transfer medium. just like information on a computer disk. You know, the disk is empty when you start, and then you place the information, you put it on the computer, and you transfer the information to the computer. Well, the universe, you know, has a computer-like aspect, which the computer is just a reflection of. You know, the mind of Manitou, the mind of the great, you know, Kishilumukong, he who dreams us into being, is fantastically intelligent. If you can use tobacco like a computer disk, you can put your thoughts into that medium, you know, kind of put it out there in the universe and transfer those thoughts to the universe. That's a pretty important thing to be able to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in general, the native people were very spiritually based people, and they were in touch with the land and in touch with the non-physical dimensions. All of them, or was that just a specialty of the shamans or the leaders?
Well, in a shamanic society, everybody has some responsibility spiritually. Everybody's supposed to be able to, like, get along and communicate directly with the spirits and with the creator itself, even if they can't access the main healer and shaman. But none of them would have the specialized ability of the town shaman. So they had these, every village would, like, have a shamanic healer, but everybody would be basically familiar with the routines, you know, the basic rituals, the basic healing. But if it was too tough a case, like a real sickness or injury, yeah, they'd almost immediately go to the shaman and say, you know, this one's too big for me, you take over. And they would offer tobacco to the shaman every time. But another thing, you know, this is like one part of it. You know, but everybody had that direct communication with the creator. They didn't really have, it wasn't like a priest where, you know, you only could go through the priest. You know, everybody had some ability. And they also, in New York, what's interesting is the New York Lenape, believe it or not, had prophets that people called prophets, and they had kind of a comeback in the 1760s, right before the American Revolution, and were wandering all over the United States giving these prophecies and teachings, and some white people actually saw these, and their names are known to us. And there's Papenhank, Wangelman, Neolin, you know, there's another one.
what were the prophecies, what were they prophesizing in the 1760s?
They were prophesizing that if they did not return to their traditional ways, you know, they were speaking mainly to natives. If they did not return to their traditional ways, they would lose their identity. And they would be very, you know, destructive to that culture. And that turned out to be true. And so, you know, Pontiac listened to these teachers. There was one called the Delaware Prophet that he listened to. And he was very powerful. I mean, he ended up, you know, meeting his demise, Pontiac, and he was a warrior. You kind of expect that. But he was also very gifted spiritually, you know, to a certain extent. He really believed in these what these prophets were saying was true. Mm. And Tecumseh probably was a prophet himself more than his brother Tenskwatawa.
Well, we're almost out of time, but this has really been amazing. But one question I have, doesn't it seem like this sort of modern contemporary spiritual culture is really returning to some of these ways that the natives had in place? Or am I just making that up?
No, it really is true. And again, it's polarizing, where there's people becoming more and more and more materialistic, so that nothing matters but getting all the money they possibly can. And I've met a lot of these people, especially around Manhattan, and they just want millions of dollars or else they're not happy. And at the same time, there's also greatly increasing numbers of people who want to understand native shamanism and spirituality. They want to have a religious connection or spiritual connection to Mother Earth, and they can have it. There's a way to do it. It can be direct to the spirit of the Earth Mother or the spirit of the river, or they can get help from these land keepers who can be kind of an intermediary, or the living shamans who can be intermediaries. You know, there's lots of ways to do this. And once somebody has an emotional connection to the earth, then all these doors open up and the consciousness opens up in terms of communicating with these places and these sacred sites and the entities that are benevolent and are trying to heal the earth. So, again, that's what I've kind of dedicated myself to for this next couple of months of all these events where I'm teaching these things that have been passed on to me from, you know, a dozen or so different authentic elders. And, you know, so I call it connecting with the land keepers. And again, I'll just mention that it's for people going on late. It's www.algonquinculture.org. And, you know, with my email, evan.pritchard7@gmail.com. And also, you know, there's some information. I have a newsletter that I email to people who send me their email if they ask for the newsletter. It has all the events listed on it.
And your email is evan.pritchard7@gmail.com?
That's right. And mm-hmm. I have all over New York and, like I say, in Maryland, I'm having these workshops, again, 8 hours of very condensed information on how to communicate with the land keepers, how to understand them, how to identify them, how to show respect to them. Because, you know, they really don't just come out for anybody. They're mainly, you know, they're oriented towards the native people and culture and towards plants and animals. So for a lot of people, there's a little bit of a gap there that they have to kind of change in themselves, like maybe through fasting or through smudging, you know, through washing in the rivers. There might be some ritual necessary for some people to really open up, because they have to go halfway in a lot of cases to communicate with the land keepers.
The land keepers will then help us connect to the earth even more. Is that it?
Definitely, yes.
Well, no, Evan, you're an amazing encyclopedia, wealth of information.
I think.
No, your passion for collecting this native wisdom is really valuable, especially as this old culture starts to collapse. You know, so. I think it'll become more and more important. So, thanks.
Well, I've been trying very hard to preserve Algonquin culture, and it has wisdom for almost every situation that we face. And when people praise the wisdom of India, which is incredible, but you know, Algonquin culture is just as old, and Algonquin culture has numerous kinds of wisdom and different teachings. So, I've been trying to preserve it, and I think it will. The day will come again when people will look to the Algonquins and the Iroquois and the Lakota and the Cherokee, you know, for valuable, useful wisdom. In fact, I'll mention that Parks Canada, through coming to some of my lectures in Canada, adopted a new program called TEK, which is Traditional Environmental Knowledge, which is now part of recognized by the Canadian government as being, you know, a way of helping to understand environmental problems.
Wow.
I'm really happy
about that. Let's talk again soon.
Okay.
You know, I've been talking to Evan Pritchard, evan.pritchard7@gmail.com or algonquinculture.org. And Evan, I want you to listen to this song that I'm going to close with, which is a song for Mother Earth that this woman, Kathleen Knighton, wrote. And I think it's a beautiful song that sort of talks about this connection to the earth. So I'm going to just play that. But thanks. I'll be in touch with you anyway. Okay,
Evan? Good. Well, I hope to hear from you soon.
Definitely. Okay, this is the Mother Earth song, Kathleen Knighton. And I'm Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. Email me at newrealities@earthlink.net or check my website, newrealities.com. And this is Kathleen Knighton.
My mother's arms are the mountains. They grab and hold me tight, and they rock me to sleep on this Hudson Valley night. My mother's heart is in the roots. Sometimes water's thicker than blood. Up the trunk and to the fruits, to the birds flying up above. But although she is screaming now, my mother's voice can't be heard. So I'm lending her mine tonight, and I'm singing this song for her. got these hands made for working. I'm gonna give them to the earth. Though I know I can't repay her, I'm gonna give it all it's worth. I've got these legs made for walking. I'm gonna stop standing still. I'm gonna march for my mother. I'm gonna journey up that hill. My mother's heart is in the roots. Sometimes water is thicker than blood. Up the trunk into the fruits. To the birds flying up above. But although she is screaming out, my mother's voice can't be heard. So I'm lending her mine tonight, and I'm singing the song for her. We've got these eyes made for seeing, but we often look away. When we know it's gonna be hard, when we know we gotta change. We've got these ears made for hearing, so listen for the blowing wind. Cause a mother's calling out for children, and it's time to come home again. Cause our mother's heart is in the roots. Sometimes water's thicker than blood. Up the trunk into the fruits. To the birds flying up above. But although she is screaming,